what we've got here is...
is just another day on Capitol Hill. I mean, who gave that speech the other night? Was it President Obama or Joe Wilson?
What the American people got wasn't a new health care plan. It was just another lecture.
The math doesn't add up and the record doesn't add up.
It was a shameful act. I'm hopeful that Joe Wilson will apologize personally to the president.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Failure to communicate? Cool. But is it news? Sure. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, September 11th. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, predicting the economic recovery one cardboard box at a time. South Carolina politicians gone wild. It's not a reality show. It's just reality. And we hear stories from this day 8 years ago, remembering the attacks of September 11th, 2001. But first, good morning to Jay Newton Small, Washington reporter for Time Magazine. Good morning, Jay. I have one quick question. Do we really have a blueprint on health care there in Washington, or is it just more rah-rah team for the Democrats at this point?
Well, that depends a great deal on what you're trying to build. Do we have a blueprint for, say, the Taj Mahal? No. But if Dems can cheer for the layout for my one-bedroom apartment, then we're getting places.
I love it.
And, you know, there's a housing crisis, too, still.
That's great. We'll elaborate on that metaphor in just a moment. Stay with us, Jay. We'll be back. But first, everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, the president leads the country in a moment of silence this morning at 8:46 a.m. to remember the victims of the September 11th attacks. That's 8:46 Eastern time when the first plane hit the World Trade Center back in 2001. Afterward, the president meets with victims' families at the Pentagon Memorial. Vaccine makers say the new H1N1 shot could be stronger than predicted. Clinical trials show most adults will need just one dose to be protected. That means the millions of Americans who are at high risk for the virus could be vaccinated before peak flu season. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner gave an upbeat economic outlook to the congressional panel that oversees TARP bank bailout funds.
I think the U.S. financial system today is in substantially stronger shape than it was 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, and on the eve of this recession.
That's the Treasury Secretary speaking yesterday. He says we don't need some Wall Street bailout programs anymore. That says China says its economy is looking up, too. New numbers from the country's Statistics Bureau show China is likely to hit 8% growth this year. That's what many observers say is needed to maintain social stability there. We would dream of 8% growth in the United States. Our partner, the New York Times, has a front-page interview today with the leading Senate Democrat on military issues, Carl Levin. He says he's against sending more combat troops to Afghanistan until the U.S. speeds up the training of Afghan forces in that country. Carl Levin is the chair of the Armed Services Committee and is crucial on the issue of troop surges in places like Afghanistan. Meanwhile, NATO says two of its troops have been killed in eastern Afghanistan, including a U.S. service member. The Dow opens next hour at 96.28. The S&P starts trading at 10.44, and the NASDAQ begins at 20.84. Markets were up about 1% yesterday. Congressman Joe Wilson apologized, but should politicians always be civil to each other?
This is Richard Cavish from NIAC. Our job as politicians, and I work out here in NIAC, New York, is to get the people's business done, and that business is done much more easily and with much greater comity if we as public figures get along and don't let personal agendas get in the way.
Give us your personal agenda at 8778-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everybody. John Hockenberry here, flying solo on The Takeaway this morning. Lots to talk about this morning. The question for you today is concerning Joe Wilson, a conservative Republican from South Carolina who screamed on Wednesday night, "You lie," in the middle of President Obama's health care speech. I mean, here's the question. Why can't Congress sound like those town halls that we heard about all summer? Or say Question Time, the Brits, you know, they make a lot of noise in their parliament over in London. Should politicians always be civil to each other? We've gotten tons of responses. This one from Carolyn, who writes on our website, "Joe Wilson's behavior was shameful. He's the reason that intelligent Republicans will have to leave the party rather than be identified with the craziness that's occurring more and more." Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org like Carolyn did. But now let's begin with healthcare. And yesterday, there were predictions. Yes, something's going to happen, but when?
I believe we will have a bill. I went to Congress a long, long time, been there for eight presidents. I think we'll have a bill before Thanksgiving.
Okay, Vice President Joe Biden making his prediction on NBC's Today Show yesterday. For more on what's ahead for the health care bill is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, and Jay Newton Small, Washington reporter from Time, is still with us. Welcome to both of you. Jay, the president was supposed to get specific on Wednesday, and it seems to me there's a major strategy shift here. I mean, on Capitol Hill, are we operating from an actual plan that the Democrats have now? Or are we pretty much just rallying the troops and the president has to figure out if he can hold the numbers at this point, no matter what the actual plan turns out to be? Jay?
There is still a process going on in the Senate, and that is Senate Finance Chairman Max Baucus is still rallying his six members, three Democrats, three Republicans, to try and come up with a deal. Their deadline is September 15th, and they felt very empowered by the president's speech. They felt that it was so similar to what they're working on there. They're working on a platform where it's only about $900 billion. It's deficit neutral. It's, you know, a lot of the provisions that the president actually laid out in his, you know, joint address of Congress were very similar. So they felt that was an endorsement of their process.
So you mentioned, Jay Newton Small from Time Magazine, $900 billion. John McCain was talking $1 trillion in his reaction yesterday. Todd Zwillick, is this trillion-dollar cost number going to be a big issue going forward?
Well, they've been trying for a long time to stay under that trillion-dollar cost number. That's sort of the $1 trillion is sort of the psychological brick wall, isn't it? Max Baucus' draft plan that he put out just last week is well under the trillion-dollar mark. The House, many of the House bills are over it. And I think that psychological point of the $1 trillion is going to be a marker for the rest of the negotiations. Mm. The president, in his speech the other night, I think came in at $900. I think you're going to see a real effort to come in well under $1 trillion, because for a lot of moderates on the Democratic side, and for any of the couple of few Republicans who have a chance of signing on to this, trillion is an important number. And not just $1 trillion, the overall cost is a very important number, especially for your moderate Republicans, your Olympia Snows and Susan Collins. They are very concerned about the overall price tag, as not as much as, but almost as much as what the policy is. So 900 or below is what I would expect.
All right, let's talk about the process, because it is a bit mysterious to me. And you raised the issue of Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, the important moderate Republicans in the Senate. They're also Blue Dog Democrats in the House, Jay Newton Small and Todd Zwillick. If I'm a constituent who's really concerned about this, do I even bother sending a letter to my own congressperson, or should I just send it directly to Olympia Snow or Collins, or should I send it to the White House, or should I send it to Max Baucus? I mean, it seems to me the House will have a bill, the Senate will have a bill, then there's going to be this conference committee. I don't know who to lobby here.
That's a great question, and you would probably have to know more about the dynamics of the Congress than most people outside the Beltway do know to decide whom to send your letter to. You know, if you live in the district of a House Republican, unless it's one or two or three of them, chances are they're not worth writing to. You can certainly express your displeasure with them if you want health reform passed or you like the president, of course.
It's not as though you're saying they're not worth writing to because there's something wrong with them. It's just they're not going to be decisive.
It's because they are decisive. They have decided not to support Democrats on this, just like on the stimulus. Now, if you're following the Senate process very closely, I would write to Susan Collins. I would write to Chuck Grassley.
Even if you live in Nebraska.
Sure, why not? Because they're making – now, Will, you might want to lie about your address and put a false return address on the envelope, to the extent that people still send snail mail, because they do tend to pay much more attention to people in their states and in their districts. But, John, your point is well taken. There are only a select few Republicans left in the Congress who have any hope of signing on to this. The other day we mentioned George Voinovich of Ohio, who is a moderate and is retiring, does not have to run for re-election, might be a flexible vote on this. But the number of Republicans who could sign on is dwindling. You might also consider writing to those moderate Dems, to Ben Nelson and Evan Bayh and Mary Landrieu and Blanche Lincoln, all moderate Democrats in the Senate, if you were for the president, that is, or against him, to say you really need to consider joining the Democrats on this, or you really need to not consider. But, and I say that because those are important pivot points now.
All right, Jay Newton Small, do the Democrats hold it together here? And feel free to give me a suggestion on who to lobby for. You know, Todd gave me a couple. But, I mean, can the Democrats hold it together, or is it going to be basically peeling away moderates, then peeling away conservatives and peeling away progressives between now and Joe Biden's fictitious Thanksgiving deadline?
Well, first of all, I think that most people find writing, or most people who've written senators out of state will find that it's a bit like writing to Santa Claus. You're never really going to get an answer. Look, Obama hosted about 17 moderate Democrats at the White House yesterday.
This was the 415, the big strategy meeting, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that was his sort of indication of who he's looking to really keep on board right now. And he's, you know, he's trying to hold his center. He's trying to hold all of his Democrats. If they can get someone seated in Teddy Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts, that gives them 60 votes. They've got maybe Olympia Snowe from Maine, who they've still been talking to. But, you know, I spoke with Senator Collins yesterday. I spoke with Senator Voinovich, and both of them said that they haven't heard from the White House in months, that nobody's reaching out to them. And so it seems that they're really trying to almost do this alone, to just go with Democrats. And they're not too worried about the moderate Republicans, at least for the moment.
You know, I'm just wondering if your impression, and Todd, you have plenty of experience here, is the Obama administration good with the face-to-face politics, or do they prefer to just do the bully pulpit thing, the big speech on television? I'm getting the impression that they prefer the TV speech and aren't terribly good on the face-to-face side. Jay, and then Todd.
I agree. I mean, look, they haven't done that much lobbying behind the scenes. They haven't done the one-on-one meetings. It's not like he's locking himself in a room with the 20 most important members and coming up with legislation. And that's been a really big problem for him, because that's what's needed in the Senate desperately.
Todd?
You know, that was supposed to be the beauty of having Tom Daschle do this job, this healthcare
right,
job,
right.
Was that face-to-face. Okay, so Daschle's not here. We accept that. Biden,
he was going to be the head of HHS, so he would have been the principal lobbyist, right? But then he didn't make it through the vetting.
Right. He was going to be the principal lobbyist and the point man on health reform. He was going to be both of those things, those two jobs simultaneously. Biden is an old Senate man and has been conspicuously absent. Now, he doesn't exactly have a big health care portfolio, but he is the big Senate guy. And a lot of people have been sort of amazed that as much outreach ability that as the White House has on Capitol Hill, like Rahm Emanuel in the House and Joe Biden in the Senate, just for starters, that they haven't done more of the face-to-face.
So the next week will really tell the tale of what details will eventually emerge from the House and the Senate, and really the showdown will be in the conference committee when the House and Senate reconcile. Who's going to be the power broker there, Todd? And then you get a final remark from Jay.
Well, that's really unclear. Traditionally, the Senate is the power broker on these things because you need more votes, and the Senate is more moderate. But the House is so split right now still between the progressives, who demand the public option, and the blue dogs, many of the blue dogs who demand no public option, that it actually gives the House writ large more power, because once they do reach an agreement, it has to hold together. There are some liberal Democrats who after this powerful speech the other night are saying, well, we have to get something passed. They're going to try to support the president as long as they have
right.
something that meets the
so there's a
meets
window
the, meets the imperatives of the public option. Right.
There's a
so
solidarity window here.
Solidarity. Usually the Senate is more powerful in these things, though. The power usually rests with the Senate, because you have to cobble together more of a consensus to get to conference in the first place.
Okay, Jay, listen to this, and then I want to ask you the question we're asking all of our listeners this morning.
Will the Chancellor, sitting there in front of us, still be in his post in a week's time?
Mr. Speaker, once again, it's nothing to do with policy.
So they don't need to be polite over in Britain. Do we here, thinking about Joe Wilson, need to do that here in the United States? 2 seconds, Jay.
Well, the House isn't known for its civility, but in this case, the joint session of Congress, President of the United States, it's pretty much expected.
Jay Newton-Small from Time Magazine, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, guys. Civility. It's a theme this morning. We're looking for your take on Congressman Joe Wilson. Should politicians be off the cuff like they are in Britain, or always polite? On our site, thetakeaway.org, Merle writes, "It's so interesting that the one who shouted, 'You lie,' told the truth, while the ones who failed to defend him continued the deception. He decried, 'Go, Joe.'" Meanwhile, Lola writes back, "Have you actually read the bill? There's no coverage for illegal immigrants. Read the bill, get the facts, then make up your mind." We'd love to hear what's on your mind. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. So on The Takeaway, we're kind of sick of thinking outside the box. In just a moment, we're going to look at the economy from inside the cardboard box. We'll explain, but first... Quick update now from the mighty Quinn himself, Mark Quinn, host of South Carolina Educational Television and Radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. He joins us from the studios of SCETV in South Carolina. Mark Quinn, good morning.
John, one of these days, I'm going to come on the radio and I'm going to have something good to say about South Carolina, I promise.
You know, that's the question. I mean, since Joe Wilson made that liar remark on Wednesday night, we've been getting a lot of reaction from residents of your state. Listen to this.
A lot of us in South Carolina, I'm sure, want to completely apologize for the outburst. Many of us have labored for over 100 years trying to improve the image of people from the Southeast, and we have a long way to go still, apparently.
Is that the kind of reverberation you're getting there in South Carolina to Joe Wilson sort of lipping off at the president?
I would say more of that than not. Now, of course, in this state, as ruby red as you're going to get, he does have his backers. He does have people who say, oh, way to stand up for yourself there, Joe. But by and large, the phone call that you just heard right there is more of what I've been hearing, that even if they thought he was right, that it was such a complete lack of civility that, you know, good Southerners just don't act that way.
That's right. And civility is what being from South Carolina is all about. Here's Alice Barker, who's a listener who called.
This is Alice Barker. I'm from South Carolina, and I enjoyed Obama's speech, but I was once again embarrassed to be from South Carolina thanks to Joe Wilson. I felt that was very disrespectful of the office of the president.
Now, disrespect or not, does this change at all the dynamics? I mean, is Joe Wilson's seat safe? Are there people in the GOP worried about what's going on in that state?
Look, you know, that there's an old saying, Scott Huffman, my political science analyst on my program, always tells me, you know, in some of these districts in South Carolina, if you're a Republican, you're safe unless you're caught in bed with a dead woman or a live boy. You know, I mean, it's just that easy to win. I mean, that might be a crude way to put it.
That is a crude way to put it, actually, Mark. Yeah.
But his opponent, who he ran against last time, Rob Miller, will be running against him again next time. He's already raised $500,000 just in the last 24 hours alone.
All right.
A lot of that's come from across the country. So, you know, he will have a significant challenge this time. But, you know, in this state, the way the districts are drawn and gerrymandered,
it's tough to say. Let's change the subject a little bit here, okay?
What I am certainly trying to say is that it is not okay to short-circuit an ethics process to try and get the result that you want.
Actually, we didn't change the subject. That's your governor, Mark Sanford. That's a whole other embarrassment there, right? We didn't even get a chance to talk about that. Quick update on Mark.
He seems to be taking leave of his senses a little bit more every single day.
Well, I mean, stay safe down there in South Carolina. We got to go, Mark Quinn. But great stuff. Mark Quinn, host of the South Carolina ETV and Radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. Thanks, Mark. So we talked about thinking out of the box regarding the economy. We've got our two economic buddies here in the studio with us, Lakshman Achuthan, who's managing director at Economic Cycle Research Institute, a market analysis company. Good morning, Lakshman.
Good morning.
And Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, good morning.
Good morning.
So we're going to run down a list of economic indicators, and let's begin with what we're really trying to see in this economy right now. The pain of the recession is still there, but signs of structural changes in the economy are all over the place, and you're looking at them. Let's begin with the trade deficit.
Well, yeah, that caught everybody off guard. It was surging imports and higher exports, and it went against the grain of all the doom and gloom because
exactly.
It says, hey, people are buying and selling stuff all over the world. In fact, the higher exports show that the world economy is breathing again, and the higher imports, which were a record high increase, okay,
yeah.
The highest increase we've ever seen, shows you that there's demand in the U.S. economy, even for those expensive imported goods. And what gives? I think what it shows
us. Some people
us,
can get credit. It's been
some people can get credit. Look, I'm not saying people aren't hurting. There are plenty of millions of people who are hurting. There are many more millions who are. Who've survived this recession, who are coming out of their bunkers, looking around, and they see low prices, and they're buying things. And what you see is that the more things seem to change, the more they actually may stay the same. I think the U.S. economy, not China, is leading this global recovery as it has so many times in the past.
So why are you looking inside the boxes for some answers on the economy, Lachman?
Well, here we look at one of the kind of weird, wacky indicators is old corrugated boxes, boxes that are sitting there on the sidewalk. And what they tell you is what's going on with activity. At the beginning of the year, if you went outside, we were talking among the people in our office, you went outside, you couldn't tell if it was recycling day because you couldn't see if there were any boxes. No boxes were piled up on the sidewalk to be taken away. Now, when you look outside your door, and I encourage you to do this, you're going to start to see piles of cardboard boxes. That means that activity buying is happening again. Mm. People are purchasing. Again.
Soon to come, the Lachman Achuthan Box Index. So we'll be reporting on this program. Louise Story, your story, if I may say so, is actually about the hedge funds in a nonprofit sector called higher education. Harvard and Yale had serious investment troubles, which is perhaps a bellwether for the entire nonprofit sector. What's the news?
Well, Harvard's endowment is down 27%. Yale's is down around 30%. This is big money we're talking about at Harvard. That's $10 billion. Poof. Gone.
And you went to Yale.
I went to Yale. It's very discouraging when you, as an alumni, give all this money to a school. And I remember raising money for our reunion a couple years ago, and it's gone. So what this means for nonprofits in general and the rest of universities is that there were big losses from last year. We all sort of knew it. We didn't know how big. In fact, at others, the losses could be far graver because, you know, Harvard and Yale are known for their investing savvy and great strategies. And so at these schools, they're cutting back. Yale has a number of construction projects.
So programmatic consequences are going to be clear from this.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the interesting irony is that in a recession economy, enrollment tends to be up at universities, but they can't necessarily use that increased revenue to compensate for these huge losses, right?
Well, I mean, you know, what do you pay to go to school? $40,000, $50,000? That does not add up to a loss of $10 billion or more. So that doesn't add up. And the other thing is, you know, a lot of students in school are getting financial aid. Some schools may take fewer people financial aid, but Yale and Harvard are saying they're not going to change that policy.
So economic bellwethers for people in school, for people looking for boxes on the side of the street, for people watching their imports. Lachman Achuthan, thanks so much for joining us. And as always, Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times. Thanks so much. And now let's check in with the top news stories from Femi Okeh with the headlines.
At 29 minutes past the hour, American and Australian vaccine producers say clinical trials show that the new H1N1 shot is strong enough to protect adults with just a single injection. And coming up in a few minutes' time at 8:46 a.m. Eastern Time, President Obama will lead the country in remembering the victims of 9/11 with a moment of silence. Those are some of the stories we're watching today.
Coming up, Afghanistan vis-a-vis 9/11, a remembrance there in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Femi Okeh has been reporting all morning long. There will be memorials for today's events. 8 years ago today, the attacks of September 11th here in New York, the Pentagon, of course, the crash of Flight 93, which was one of the hijacked airplanes. And in many ways, while the World Trade Center site was smoldering in the United States, places around the world lit up as America thought of how to respond to the 9/11 attacks.
Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen.
That's President George W. Bush addressing Congress September 20th, 2001, just literally a week or so after September 11th. And, of course, places did light up all over the world. Here to share some remembrances of the international implications of what happened on 9/11 is Charlie Sennett, our friend, executive editor and founder of Global Post, a new online international news organization which has done an enormous amount of coverage of Afghanistan most recently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 8 years after September 11th, Afghanistan is probably a pretty good place to look at the aftermath of those attacks.
Yeah, you know, I remember arriving in Afghanistan on about September 19th, 2001, and it was like walking on the moon. This is a country that had been so ravaged by so much war. And when you got there and you saw the devastation of the place, what a failed state it was, and you felt like we are going to be here for a long time.
You felt that then?
You could tell that this country's not coming around anytime soon. And, you know, 8 years later, there are things that have been achieved in Afghanistan. that are remarkable and that are worth pointing out. That said, militarily, it is really shaping up as a doomed intervention.
Yet, as I think back and look back, and we actually went through some of the archives here to listen to some of the coverage. I mean, when the Taliban was rolled back in Afghanistan, when Karzai was inaugurated, there was all this sort of heroic, well, look what we did in response to 9/11. Yet, al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's number two,
yep,
is still at large. Osama bin Laden is still at large. Al-Qaeda is still believed to have some sort of leadership holding up on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's worth noting how little has been accomplished, even though so much has been accomplished.
I mean, there were fateful mistakes that were made right in Tora Bora in December when the U.S. failed to commit sufficient ground troops to stop the retreat of the Taliban and al-Qaeda elements that went into Pakistan. The United States was then distracted, I think, by the war in Iraq for so many years that the Taliban and al-Qaeda were able to survive and regroup. And I think they really splintered, they fractured, and they became something very different. And I think right now the struggle across these two borders, Afghanistan and Pakistan, is a very difficult one. It's going to be very hard to get this done. It is not a monolithic Taliban. It is a fractured al-Qaeda. And it involves a country in which we can't really get in there. I mean, they're not going to be able to penetrate Pakistan, and nor should they, because it would expand the war terribly. So where this thing goes is very difficult to say. But this call by McChrystal, by General McChrystal, for more troops is increasingly not popular, as we see today coming out from the Democrats, and I think perilous.
Well, let's listen to what the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, said precisely on that subject yesterday.
I don't think there's a great deal of support for sending more troops to Afghanistan in the country or in the Congress.
Now, that either says that America got 9/11 really, really wrong by going into Afghanistan, but I'm wondering if there's an inevitability here. Mm. There had to be a response. There hasn't been an attack. Basically, this is the price we pay for no more attacks.
Well, I think there's a question, though, is have we reached that price? You know, for a long time, I am completely in agreement with you that we needed to respond to the attack on our country.
There needed to be a response of some sort.
Well, I think that the idea that the Taliban had this sort of leveraged buyout by al-Qaeda, by bin Laden, was so perilous for our country that kind of response was needed. We did topple the Taliban government. We succeeded in at least fracturing al-Qaeda. But now, 8 years later, you have to wonder, what is the strategy here? What is the end game? What are we trying to accomplish? And as I increasingly hear commanders talk about defeating the Taliban, that's a whole new strategy. We are not going to win that one.
Well, you know, you ask, what is the end game here? The end game in civic terms, in sort of nation building terms in Afghanistan, increasingly sounds like this.
We are talking about hundreds of polling stations which were never opened, and votes have been reported from those. And those numbers are included, which has taken Mr. Karzai about 50%.
That's leading presidential opposition candidate Abdullah Abdullah talking about corruption in the election. It looks like Karzai will be restored to power. There will be a runoff. What do you make of the democratic nation building 8 years after 9/11 in Afghanistan?
Well, I think some aspects of the nation building have been quite successful, but this election is not a success. And this rush to claim success that we talked about the last time I was on, was exactly that. It was a rush without the real deal of the success. This was widespread fraud.
Is that based on your reporting in Afghanistan, do you think, or is that a kind of an impression you have as a journalist who's maybe likely to be skeptical?
Well, we have a tremendous reporter on the ground in Kabul, in Jean McKenzie, who very uniquely travels all around the country. Unlike most journalists who are there, you know, it's very difficult to travel. When I was there, I didn't get much out of Kabul. She is constantly seeing this whole country and works with a network of freelancers who are all over the country. And what they were saying right from the beginning was women did not show up for the vote in the southeast. There was tremendous campaign of fear that was successful by the Taliban, which kept voter turnout down. Fraud is rampant. I mean, this is really not an election that's going to be accepted by the Afghan people as legitimate. Hmm. And one of the things the U.S. government and its international allies can do right now is focus on process. The troop buildup, I think, is increasingly being seen as a mistake. But I think that one thing that can be done is to really go after this election and try to enhance its legitimacy by rooting out this fraud, and then recognizing there are local structures that can really be brought to bear here. The Loya Jirga, using the institutions of Afghanistan
itself. Tribal sort of parliamentary
like a grand
procedure.
Council of tribes
right.
that can come
town
together.
Town meeting. Afghanistan town meeting.
It's a place where Afghanistan has always gone in crisis throughout its history. And I'm wondering if that isn't something that will come into play here.
Well, Charlie Sennett, executive editor and founder of Global Post, a new online international news service where you can see some of his reporting on Afghanistan. The takeaway is whatever memorials are put up in the United States, one of the legacies of 9/11 will certainly be seen for many years to come in Afghanistan. Thanks to you, Charlie. And now let's check in with some headlines from Femi Okay.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The president will lead the country in remembering the victims of 9/11 with a moment of silence. That's just coming up in a couple of minutes from now at 8:46 a.m. Eastern Time. Today marks the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. This is the first time that the day has been declared a national day of service. And American and Australian vaccine producers say that clinical trials show that the new H1N1 shot is strong enough to protect adults with just a single injection. Those are the main stories we're following this morning.
Thanks, Femi. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
This is DJ calling from New Jersey.
So DJ called us the other day with, you might call it a complaint.
What is the reason that in one of the very best countries in the world, America, the people are the least happy?
That's a really good question, DJ.
Everything is amazing right now, and nobody's happy.
I'm Leah from South Carolina. Everything has to cause division. No matter what it is, somebody has to complain about it.
You know, this really hit a chord. I mean, we heard from Leah there, who was responding to just one of the big brouhahas of the week.
I think it's a sad day when somebody wants to encourage our children and inspire our children, and people take issue with that.
You know what she's talking about. The president decided to talk to school children in their classes in a speech telling them to be sure and graduate and to work hard.
Every single one of you has something to offer, and you have a responsibility to yourself to discover what that is. That's the opportunity an education can provide.
But he could also have been secretly hypnotizing them so they would vote for Democrats for the rest of their lives. Lot to complain about there.
The fact that the White House can send out teaching materials to every school in the country, I think that's something that parents should be deeply concerned about.
Which gets us back to our listener pal, DJ.
Why do they complain about everything? About their politicians, their government, taxes? I'd love to hear what the listeners have to say.
The DJ has a point here about complaining. But we should remember that some people actually make a fantastic living complaining about really, really stupid stuff.
What has happened with the packaging of CDs? These are angry, angry people, these CD packagers. Open here. Is that sarcasm?
There's nothing worse than thinking you have milk and not having it. You go to lift up the carton and it's too light. Ah!
Now we live in an amazing, amazing world, and it's wasted on the crappiest generation of just spoiled idiots.
Now, a generation of spoiled idiots is perhaps harsh, but complaints were certainly part of that healthy debate this summer about health care. But seriously, without complaints from you guys out there listening, we would never have learned about some real human problems like this one.
My name is Tim Rhodes. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. I found out I had an aggressive prostate cancer with 12 to 36 months to live. My insurance company immediately said it was a pre-existing and denied coverage. I now have 60 medical bills, and it's a fiscal and financial nightmare.
Too many have used this as an opportunity to score short-term political points, even if it robs the country of our opportunity to solve a long-term challenge. And out of this blizzard of charges and countercharges, confusion has reigned.
I think that you like to hear yourself complaining. Why don't you like anything? Get over
loving to complain, loving to hear yourself complain. Maybe it's the secret to American democracy, but we can't forget about that good old American positive stiff upper lip alternative.
I have a job interview today at 3 o'clock, and I'm in my car commuting for my new job.
I think the health care that we have is really good.
To live in a country that has that many opportunities that gives someone a chance is pretty terrific.
I'm not complaining, I'm having no trouble today.
Many thanks to our listener DJ for the idea to talk about all this. Want to pitch something to us? Well, you know the number for our own complaint box. It's 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Oh, I can't complain.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. 8 years and 1 minute ago, the first plane struck the tower at the World Trade Center, beginning what we commemorate today as the events of the attacks on 9/11/2001. The president is leading the nation in a moment of silence, commemorating those attacks here in New York, the Pentagon in Washington, and of course the crash of Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. And 8 years ago today, the question for people in New York is, where were you then? Of course, it's not as eerie today as it's been for a lot of the anniversaries of September 11th. It was a beautiful sunny day 8 years ago. Today it's cloudy, so it's not as eerie. And thinking about that day, we have our memories inside. When those planes hit the World Trade Center, when that plane hit the Pentagon, and when Flight 93 went down. One of the themes of that day is all the lives that were thrown together in those horrible moments and then ripped apart tragically for all time for many of them, because we all moved on. Joining us is Sarah Bunting now. She's a writer and publisher of the blog TomatoNation.com. She remembers where she was on September 11th. In fact, she remembers who she was thrown together with, who she was disconnected from that for 8 years or so now. So, Sarah, tell me that story.
Well, I was downtown. I was on a panel, speaking on a panel about, I believe, internet content valuation. Very exciting stuff.
Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, you sort of remember everything from the day. But I was downtown. We, you know, heard what was going on. We went to have a look, my panel mates and I. And then the first tower to go down, Tower 2, began to fall. And I sort of walked away, not thinking running would do much good, and found myself in the Bank of New York. And I was there with this man named Don.
And we should point out, a rubble-covered, dust-covered, you know, the aftermath was everywhere around you.
Yeah, yeah. When we looked out the windows of the Bank of New York, there was nothing to see, just dust, debris. We went outside briefly at about 10:30, but then, of course, it repeated itself. But I became aware of Don because he was asking a bank guard what the vault was like, whether we could hide there, just logistical questions.
A calm, and, cool, collected soul in the middle of something pretty emotionally raging.
Relative to me, yeah. Yes.
You were a mess.
Yeah. Well, I was nothing, but at least someone was taking charge and asking some questions like, you know, where's the bathroom and can we civilians use the, you know, drink your water from your water cooler? So I decided to stand near him and listen to any answers he was getting, which weren't many. And then we just sort of found ourselves deciding without saying so to stand together, to at least have someone to talk to. It all felt so unreal that to just have another human being to make small talk with even was a mental lifesaver that day.
And that was the last time you saw him?
Yeah.
Don. Right.
Yeah. The last time I saw him, we were told to leave by a firefighter, and we walked over to the FDR Drive, and there was a call for ferries taking passengers back to Jersey City, mm-hmm. which that was my understanding, that that's where he lived. And he got on a ferry, and that was that. I knew him for an hour, and then he was gone.
Why have you tried to reconnect with him, and why do you think that's important to you?
I've tried to reconnect with him because I want to say thanks for keeping me sane. He's become, for me and also for readers of my blog, TomatoNation.com, sort of a symbol of the very thin but still distinct silver lining of that day, which was that people were kind to each other. They were pulling together the world.
And this
sort of
gossamer web of connections,
yeah.
that held people together on that
yeah.
day. And we should note that, of course, your story, while certainly close to ground zero, wasn't at ground zero. You didn't lose a life or you weren't injured.
No.
But this sense of connection is a theme through all of the stories, be they really tragic or be they relatively benign in a sense.
Yeah. And I think, you know, without sort of trivializing anyone else's experience or just sort of the larger event, I think that people need narrative closure. I think bringing order out of chaos is something that's important to people psychologically, to sort of feel like an event like this is something that they can understand and can incorporate into their lives.
Well, Don, if you're out there, Sarah is in our studio. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'd be happy to reconnect you. Jim Dwyer joins us now, columnist for the New York Times, author of the fantastic book, 102 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Fight to Survive Inside the Twin Towers. He co-wrote that book with Kevin Flynn. Jim Dwyer, I've talked with you in the past, but this morning, if we think of what happened on 9/11 as about connections, thinking back 8 years, is also a little bit about reconnections. And there are a lot of people who met people for the first time and last time on that day. That's really a theme in your book.
Yes, for sure. I mean, the idea of the book was to figure out what was going on that we couldn't see from the outside. I mean, they talked about 9/11 as the most photographed and or filmed event in history because there were so many people who were filming, and you know, everybody from network TV to amateurs sticking the cameras out the window. But you really didn't know what was going on, and in fact, even if you were in the building, you didn't know what was going on except in your little corner of it.
And tell me the story of Pete Negron, Carlos Da Costa, Pablo Ortiz, and Frank DeMartini, people who worked for the Port Authority, building maintenance guys whose story was unknown until you put it together.
Well, what happened was those guys worked on the 88th floor of the North Tower, and that was a Port Authority floor, the Port Authority who owned the building. And so when this thing happened, when the plane hit, they all thought there was a bomb in the building. They didn't, you know, they didn't realize the plane had hit. They just knew there was a lot of rubble and in some parts of their floor there were fire.
And they knew the building because they were the building guys.
They knew the building. Frank DeMartini was an architect, and the others all worked in different aspects of the building. And anyway, they got everybody off of their floor. They kind of ushered them all to the stairway. And while they were in the stairway, they hear pounding from above them, from a flight above them. And they went up those stairs, and they pried open the door, and there were a whole group of people who had been unable to open the exit door. Apparently, a lot of doors got knocked out of plumb by the impact of the plane. So they pried open the door, and I guess, you know, 30, 40 people came out of that floor. There was a law firm. There was a bunch of insurance companies. And they had no idea who Pablo Ortiz and Frank DeMartini were, or any of these other folks. It just all of a sudden the door comes open. They're panicking because the floor is melting beneath their feet, literally, on that.
You know, the idea of these quiet guys helping people out, not knowing their own fate, and of course they didn't make it out of the building, we should say that.
Right.
I mean, is really emblematic of the importance of that moment of that day and how it's almost impossible to reconnect with it even 8 years later, Jim.
Yeah, these are not dramatic moments, you know.
Except their life and death.
We eventually found out that Ortiz and DeMartini had gone through pretty much every floor from the 78th, from the, I guess, around the 91st or the 90th, down to the 78th floor.
70 people saved by those building guys. And, of course, the story is in 102 Minutes, the untold story of the fight to survive inside the Twin Towers. Thanks so much to author Jim Dwyer. We've already got an email from Robert, who knew Frank DeMartini, the architect we were just talking about. Frank was a fellow dad at his son's elementary school. Robert writes, his widow worked in the other tower. He had got, but had gotten out, and she picked up their children, and they were on their way home walking over the Brooklyn Bridge. She had this sense that once DeMartini knew that his family was okay, he could go back into the towers and get more people out of the building. He certainly did. Robert says, I still take every September 11th as my own holiday and go back to where I was that day and retrace our steps of my own evacuation back home. How do you remember today? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg speaking moments ago at the World Trade Center site.
8 years we have come together to commemorate this anniversary. And just as our hearts return to those that we lost, we also remember all those who spontaneously rushed forward to help, however and whomever they could. Their compassion and selfless acts are etched in our city's history. Inspired by what they did that day, President Obama has designated 9/11 as an annually recognized National Day of Service and Remembrance. And appropriately, the City of New York has been the first to take up that call. From this day forward, we will safeguard the memories of those who died by rekindling the spirit of service that lit our city with hope and helped keep us strong.
That's New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg speaking at the World Trade Center site called Ground Zero since September 11th, 2001. Also, our thanks to Sarah Bunting, who told the story of spending an hour with Don in a building amidst the rubble 8 years ago today, someone she's trying to reconnect with. She wanted to wish him a happy birthday this morning. Our thoughts go out to all the victims and families affected by 9/11. I'm John Hockenberry. You're listening to The Takeaway. So we learned that speaking with your foot in your mouth is apparently not difficult for South Carolina Congressman Joe Wilson.
They wanted me to contact the White House and state that my statements were inappropriate. I did. I'm very grateful that the White House, in talking with them, they indicated that they appreciated the call.
Liar, liar, something's on fire. We'll put it out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, September 11th, 2009. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, we look at Al-Qaeda 8 years after the September 11th attacks of 2001. Then we find out what Congress is doing with all that bailout money. Could be a good thing. And it's a rookie journalist, apocalyptic robots, and a bad grandma on Movie Friday here at The Takeaway. But first, good morning to Tennessee Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, Republican member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee in Tennessee. Congresswoman Blackburn, I was making a bit of sport over your colleague, Joe Wilson, but the serious question for you is, does the GOP end up taking something of a hit for what Congressman Joe Wilson did on Wednesday night?
That type action, the decorum, the civility, or the lack of civility of the House reflects not only on Republicans, on Democrats, and on Congress as a whole. And if we look at what our takeaway was from August, it is that people are very passionate about the debates that are in front of us. I know that Representative Wilson was disappointed in himself. He has appropriately and quickly responded and apologized. And I think it's a reminder to us that the American people would like to see civility from both sides.
Well, Congresswoman Blackburn, I love that takeaway. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. In the headlines, of course, this sound. It's the sound of a bell tolling at the World Trade Center in New York City at 8:46 this morning as mourners held a moment of silence to mark the time that the first plane hit on September 11, 2001. Immediately following, victims, family members, and volunteers who helped clean the attack site began reading the names of those who died 8 years ago today. In other headlines, vaccine makers say the new H1N1 shot could be stronger than predicted. Clinical trials on the new vaccine show most adults will only need one dose to be protected, and that means millions of Americans who are at high risk for the virus could be vaccinated before the peak of the flu season. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says the economy is on the mend. Geithner says we don't need some of those Wall Street bailout programs anymore. He expects the banks to pay back $50 billion in bailout funds in the next 18 months. That says China says its economy is now looking up and it's also moving the market. New numbers from the country's Statistics Bureau show China is likely to hit 8% growth this year. That's what many observers say is needed to maintain social stability there. It's certainly making a positive opening on Wall Street possible. The Dow opens at 96.27. The S&P starts trading at 10:44, and the NASDAQ begins at 20:84. Joe Wilson apologized for saying you lied to President Obama on Wednesday night, but here's a question.
Taylor Hall, Salt Lake City, Utah. For those who have never seen the House of Commons over in England, that's what I think we could use some more of in this country, with our representatives saying things like, I would kind of like to state that the gentleman over there is a jackass.
All right, who needs civility in Congress? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us yours.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Well, Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn said it a moment ago. It reflected badly on the entire government. Yes, as we try to decipher where health care goes from here on out after President Obama's speech to a joint session of Congress on Wednesday night, there have been a lot of headlines responding to Congressman Joe Wilson, who called the president a liar in the middle of that speech. The repercussions have been careening around Washington since the speech on Wednesday night. Yesterday, Representative Wilson apologized for that outburst, calling it spontaneous. We're asking what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The South Carolina congressman, after he apologized, spoke at a press conference and said that he didn't mean it, really, that he was just did it because his leadership of his party in Congress told him to. So that's not a real apology. The people of South Carolina elected him, and they should know that he disrespected them. Unlike a Southern gentleman, he was not a gentleman. He was impolite.
Do we need respect for the government to function? Your opinion, please. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And we still have Representative Marsha Blackburn, member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Jackie Calms also joins us, Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Jackie, before I go back to Representative Blackburn, because I want to hear what her constituents are saying about this. Jackie Calms, does this hold up the debate in some sense, or does it hand Rahm Emanuel and the Obama administration something of a gift in the sense that it's easy to portray the GOP as obstructionist here? Jackie?
Well, I think a gift is exactly what it was in the phrase I would have used myself. It just sort of dramatized for the public, including people who maybe aren't so, you know, supportive of what the president is trying to do, just the sort of opposition he's up against. And that's what it suggested. I mean, it was one thing for people to see through August that some opponents were rude and, you know, not letting everybody's voices get heard as they shouted out. But it was another thing to see that from the floor of the House during a joint session of Congress. And I've covered Congress full-time or part-time over the years for 26 years. And that was back during the Reagan administration, when you really started to see this on in both parties, this sort of, you know, some sport in the audience of congressmen about, you know, indicating whether they liked or didn't like. We were just getting quite close to the British Parliament system, but you never saw that kind of rudeness,
right?
Ever.
Well, and we should point out, I mean, the Brits are doing all right. I mean, they lost their empire. Okay, we'll give them that. But, I mean, in a sense, it hasn't destroyed British democracy to have that kind of rancor in Parliament. But let's listen to Barack Obama, who was speaking on Wednesday night. And in many ways, I'm wondering if he is partly to blame for all this confusion and backbiting and complaining about the entire healthcare debate. Listen.
Too many have used this as an opportunity to score short-term political points, even if it robs the country of our opportunity to solve a long-term challenge. And out of this blizzard of charges and countercharges, confusion has reigned.
So the reigning president, Representative Marsha Blackburn, says confusion has reigned. And one could argue that as impolitic and impolite as Joe Wilson was, he was attempting to get clarity from the president. Isn't it the president's responsibility to make this debate clearer? And is confusion partly his fault here?
There is confusion on exactly what that bill, H.R. 3200, would do, because the president has said one thing. You've had the promises the president has made that the bill would deliver, that health care reform would deliver. Unfortunately, in Tennessee, many of those same type promises were made with our health care system. Those promises were broken, and that program nearly broke the bank. Tennessee had the test case for public option health care.
And Massachusetts, we should point out, is struggling with the public option,
right,
as well, the mandate option anyway.
That's exactly right. And Maine has had problems. So there is no example where public option has worked. There's also the confusion. They say, well, this doesn't allow this abortion funding. It doesn't allow funding for illegal immigrants. But the problem is the language in the bill doesn't explicitly exclude that. So you get into how that is written. And I think also on top of this, you had situations where unfortunate comments were made by the speaker about people that were coming to some of the events during the summer.
So anxiety and frustration was building up. That's a fair point.
And you had Harry Reid saying unfortunate things about President Bush when he was still there, and then, of course, refused to apologize.
All right. So,
and then you also had the situation when President Bush was there and trying to work on Social Security and Medicare reform, and he was heckled.
Let me remind people we're speaking with Representative Marsha Blackburn, Republican from Tennessee, and Jackie Combs is also with us, Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. So in steps, Jackie, John Boehner, a Republican leader in the House, to find some clarity here. Can he do it? Listen.
It really is time to just stop, hit the reset button, and sit down in a bipartisan way and begin to deal with what we can deal with to make our current healthcare system work better.
Jackie Combs, it seems hit the reset button is a bit of a mantra there during the Obama administration. Now to hear a Republican using it, is that going to happen? Reset?
No, it's not. I mean, the legislative process is just really getting seriously underway here in the fall. The four of the five committees that have to act have approved a bill, but really the most crucial one is the Senate Finance Committee, and it's supposed to act. But hitting, you know, it isn't. If I really, or anybody, it's not just me, most people, there's no real way that you could really start from scratch and expect to get House Republicans especially, and I think Congresswoman Blackburn would agree, and certainly most of the Senate Republicans to come along, just as Democrats in 2003 or 2005 were not going to go along with President Bush on remaking Social Security to create private accounts for individuals. Neither are Republicans going to go along with this plan that the outline that President Obama and the Democrats are working on to overhaul health care.
Well,
it's just not going to happen.
But in this particular case, Jackie Combs, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, the Democrats have the numbers in this case. And so Representative Marsha Blackburn, Republican of Tennessee, I mean, if they can railroad a bill or vote a party line vote and get something passed, do you have a campaign issue, or do you pretty much have to say to your constituents, we want reform, this isn't the best, but, you know, I definitely want to improve things, so I'm going to help out the administration here?
I think the bigger point is that they have an issue with the American people if they move forward on that. There will be an issue for them to address with the American people because the American people have spoken out clearly. All the polls indicate they do not want a government-run, government-delivered program. They do want health care reform. We all agree.
Right, but
there needs to be health care reform. So the
but that's the lack of clarity. That's the lack of clarity, though.
That's right. And, you know, their problem is going to be with the American people. My hope would be, you know, and I think Jackie would agree with this, every good relationship you have in your life is seated and grounded in respect. And there should be that respect shown from each individual to the other members of the body. It should be shown from those members of Congress to their constituents. It should be shown for the institution, and I think American people would like to see that their opinion is respected
right.
in this debate.
But I think the American people, frustrated with health care bills and issues of all kinds, they may be worried that Congress is spending its time talking about, being polite and decorum and manners. Jackie Combs, I heard you sighing there in the background. Do you want to give us a final thought here?
I don't know if it's time, but the thought I would leave is that I think, you know, you can quibble with a lot of the details of what might come out, but I think what would happen if a health care bill does pass is in reality people would see that it's anything but a new government-run system or much more government-run than we currently have with Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, and children's health benefits. And so I think that you know, the Democrats, and I think they believe this too, will get them over the line, is that better to pass something than to do nothing.
Jackie Collins, Washington reporter for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from the nation's capital. We're also speaking with Representative Marsha Blackburn, member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, who represents the state's 7th congressional district. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us. And should politicians always be civil to each other? Does it matter? It's our question for you. Alec emails us, yes. As a teacher of young children, I constantly taught, modeled, and insisted upon civil behavior in the classroom. Why should we expect any less from our politicians? To then say to reporters that he apologized because Republican leadership told him to, rather than taking responsibility for his actions, adds enormously to his mistake, she writes. I would not accept that behavior from my young students. We should not accept it from our elected representatives. Let's put them in timeout. What would you do? 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear from you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Our system basically failed its most fundamental tests. It was too fragile, too vulnerable to shocks.
We're going to have to save those banks.
Save those banks.
Save those banks.
Even if we cashier out the guys that took the big bonuses.
When they fail, they get a bonus. The taxpayer gets the bill.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Remembering the economic crisis a year ago, on the same day that people all over America are remembering the events of September 11th, 2001, this weekend, 1 year ago, we should note, the U.S. financial system changed forever. By Monday, a year ago, Lehman Brothers had filed for bankruptcy. Bank of America agreed to buy Merrill Lynch. The insurance giant AIG was asking for a $40 billion bailout from the government. If you ask Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, he might say, what a difference a year makes.
Last September, of course, we faced the risk of catastrophic financial failure and the risk of a Great Depression. And today, I believe because of comprehensive policy actions put in place since then, we are back from the edge of the abyss.
Cost $700 billion of taxpayer money to get away from the abyss. And the question is, how is all that money working for us both financially and in terms of an investment? Joining us now, probably the best person to assess how we're doing, is Elizabeth Warren, Harvard professor and chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel monitoring the bailout, where Timothy Geithner was speaking yesterday, as a so-called TARP fund. Elizabeth Warren, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Are you feeling better a year after the events of Lehman Brothers debacle, AIG, Bank of America, all the stuff we were going through a year ago?
Well, sure. Everyone feels better, I think, than we felt a year ago. I mean, it was complete chaos a year ago. People weren't sure what was going to happen. They were talking about total meltdown. The, you know, words used were words of catastrophe. And we have backed off from the abyss, as Secretary Geithner said.
But when we were using those words, catastrophe, and throwing money at the financial system, the question of how do we oversee that pile of money was really pretty challenging. Yesterday, Secretary Geithner suggested that at least $50 billion of some of the bank bailout money would be repaid as soon as between now and the end of the year. How are we doing on the payback part of all this?
Well, we're at the under 10% on the payback part of this. Yeah,
now
we're
not a good
investment. Still low on that end. Well, no. I don't mean 10% rate of return. I mean 10% of the money back. The principal. But that's not surprising. A lot of it is you know still out there, still being used because we have to remember, you know, backing up 6 inches from the abyss and saying, oh, let's dust ourselves off, problem solved, and go about business as usual. Those are not the same two things. We are still standing close to the edge. There's still a lot of hurt out there, a lot of trouble. And we can start it in the real economy. You know, I don't have to tell you, unemployment, mortgage foreclosures, people whose savings have been wiped out. We're talking about the folks that drove this economy. Remember, we had an economy that was about two-thirds driven by consumer spending. And the consumer is pretty much flat on his back right now. So we, you know, it's not as if things are up and running again. Not only that, the Congressional Oversight Panel, we've been doing these reports every single month, and we've looked at things like the amount of toxic assets that remain on the books of the banks. Remember a year ago what we were talking about? We were talking about Henry Paulson came to the American people, came to Congress and said, toxic assets on the banks of the books, you got to get rid of them. Many of those toxic assets, in fact, most of those toxic assets are still there.
Do you have a dollar amount of you know, what it looks like, what sort of reserves have to be put up against these so-called toxic assets?
Interesting you should ask that. That's exactly the question that I asked Secretary Geithner yesterday, because when we did our report, we couldn't put a dollar amount together based on the data that are available.
Ouch.
And the secretary said, don't worry.
Don't worry.
No,
all right.
That's okay. We got
all
it in
right.
hand.
Well, you know, Joe Nocera, I'm sure you know Joe. He's a, yes. a columnist for The New York Times, and he was on this program last week, and he said something I'd love to run by you. He said that of all the pots of money that went for this bailout, the one that we are least likely to get back, that the government is ever likely to see again, involves AIG. That the other side of the picture is brighter, but the AIG crater is probably going to get deeper before it gets shallower, and a lot of that money is just down a rat hole. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think AIG, the ability of AIG to repay is, as people say politely, deeply problematic. That's going to be a tough one. And you have to remember our exposure there. It's $70 billion of TARP money and another $100 billion of Treasury loans. So, you know, this is a huge commitment that we've made to AIG. And frankly, part of the problem is most of the money just went out the door in the
right.
blink of an eye. And, you know, if you'll take one second, what made it really interesting is the money went out the door. Think about this. It went out the door to a bunch of counterparties on credit default swaps. So here were people holding an obligation from an insolvent institution, and they ended up effectively with taxpayer dollars getting a 100-cent repayment. Now switch over to, say, Chrysler and GM, where the government put money in. But in those cases, it said to the bondholders, it said to the creditors, it said to the shareholders, that's it. You have to take a big haircut. You're not going to get 100% repayment. So a real shift between
those two. So the people who played the casino on the credit default swaps, they were made good. Elizabeth Warren, who's the TARP Oversight Panel chair, places in the real economy probably not made whole. I guess I'm wondering, and you've already criticized Secretary Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, for some of the things he said a year ago. Here's something he said on October 20th, 2008, and I'm wondering if there's any accountability for this statement. Listen.
This is an investment, not an expenditure, and there is no reason to believe that this program will cost taxpayers anything.
He's referring to buying stock and taking equity positions in banks as part of the bailout. Is he right about that? And if he's not, does anybody hold him accountable?
He's not only not right, he wasn't right at the moment he said it, and he knew he wasn't right. And the way we know this is what we got in the stocks and warrants in return for the initial investment of the $300 billion that he's talking about in that clip. The Congressional Oversight Panel went back and valued the stock and the warrants in the banks. Secretary Paulson told us explicitly these were par transactions. For every $100 of taxpayer money that went in, we got $100 of stocks and warrants back. We did an independent valuation and found out that, no, in fact, we got 66 cents on the dollar back. We did not get a full dollar for dollar exchange here.
Oh, so it's that's I guess the takeaway. Instead of 100 cents on the dollar, it's 60 cents on the dollar. Elizabeth Warren, chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel for the bank bailout. Thank you so much for that. We want to alert stations that we are going to stay with what is expected to be live remarks from President Barack Obama speaking at the Pentagon for the wreath laying at the memorial for the victims of that aspect of the 9/11 attacks, which took place 8 years ago today. The president will speak at the Pentagon momentarily. We will go live to those remarks. Of course, there are remembrances for the events of September 11th, 2001, taking place here in New York, where the reading of the names is going on at Ground Zero on a cloudy, rainy day here in New York City. And indeed, we've asked you to respond. What are your memories of 8 years ago? And we're getting some responses at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So Mary emails us, I was in the car and remember coming to the circle at Prospect Park. That's a park in Brooklyn, New York. There were cops all over. We were wondering what was going on. We could see the sky over Manhattan. It was very dark and it looked like a storm cloud, Mary writes. When we got home, we found out a plane had hit the first building. Then the second plane hit. My daughter was at school in Brooklyn Heights. I jumped in the car to go and get her. We were panicking, wondering what was going to happen next. Driving on the way there, the paper from the charred site at Ground Zero was filling the air. It was like it was snowing.
John, I remember that really vivid story that you told us on the Takeaway last year of your little ones when they were going to school.
It was their first day of school.
First day at school. Remarkable story.
Yeah, they're much bigger girls, and they had their first day of school. And every first day of school, actually, we remember what's going on. We're reminding you that President Obama is expected to speak live from the Pentagon. We will carry those remarks live. Maria emails us, we in the downtown community commemorated 9/11 last night in Battery Park City. A group of us, including dancers from Chinatown, a reverend, an imam, a rabbi, a community leader, singers, remembered the community spirit that brought us together during those terrible days. As the sun set, Maria emails us, we especially remembered not only what we lost, but what we gained, the strong sense of love of community that has stayed with us ever since. Some of the remembrances that are taking place around the nation and the New York area 8 years after the September 11th attacks of 2001. We also have a response from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
This is Sarah Jane Johnson, Shelby Township, Michigan. On September 11th, I watched all the horror and wondered what was happening to my aunt and her family, who were missionaries in Afghanistan at the time. I thank God every day that they got out safely.
That's Sarah reminding us of what happened 8 years ago today at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're going to get an update now on another story that we're following this morning. Joining us now is the general, you might call him, on the front lines of the H1N1 flu battle as peak season is a couple of weeks away. Anthony Fauci joins us, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Anthony Fauci, good morning.
Good morning.
So we have news this morning that the vaccine, as it's being tested now, which we originally thought would require two injections, two doses to be effective, looks like it's effective on a single dose. What's that going to mean for you?
Well, that's actually very important news because there were two really unanswered questions. A, would the vaccine even induce an immune response at all? And if so, would it require more than the usual single dose that we do when we give seasonal flu vaccines? And the data that came out yesterday evening and that I'm going to be discussing today at a later press conference with work that was done at the National Institutes of Health funded studies indicates that a single dose of the standard dose that you would generally give with seasonal vaccine in healthy adults induces an immune response that's quite robust, quite potent, that you would predict would be protective. So that has important implications in two areas. One, with regard to the supply of vaccines, so you don't have to use a lot of vaccine up with giving people two or more doses or even a high dose.
And that's going to make it easier to get the immunity and also easier to distribute the vaccine. Dr. Fauci, we're going to go to the president who's speaking live at the Pentagon, but thanks so much for being with us.
As a nation and as a people, in city streets where our two towers were turned to ashes and dust, in a quiet field where a plane fell from the sky, and here, where a single stone of this building is still blackened by the fires. We remember with reverence the lives we lost. We read their names. We press their photos to our hearts. And on this day that marks their death, we recall the beauty and meaning of their lives. Men and women and children of every color and every creed from across our nation and from more than 100 others. They were innocent, harming no one. They went about their daily lives. Gone in a terrible instant, they now dwell in the house of the Lord forever. We honor all those who gave their lives so that others might live, and all the survivors who battled burns and wounds and helped each other rebuild their lives. Men and women who gave life to that most simple of rules. I am my brother's keeper. I am my sister's keeper. We pay tribute
to the service of a new generation, young Americans raised in a time of peace and plenty, who saw their nation in its hour of need and said, I choose to serve. I will do my part. And once more, we grieve. For you and your families, no words can ease the ache of your heart. No deeds can fill the empty places in your homes. But on this day and all that follow, you may find solace in the memory of those you loved, and know that you have the unending support of the American people. Scripture teaches us a hard truth. The mountains may fall and the earth may give way, the flesh and the heart may fail. But after all our suffering, God and grace will restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. So it is, so it has been for these families, so it must be for our nation. Let us renew our resolve against those who perpetrated this barbaric act and who plot against us still. In defense of our nation, we will never waver. In pursuit of Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies, we will never falter. Let us renew our commitment to all those who serve in our defense, our courageous men and women in uniform and their families, and all those who protect us here at home. Mindful that the work of protecting America is never finished, we will do everything in our power to keep America safe. Let us renew the true spirit of that day, not the human capacity for evil, but the human capacity for good, not the desire to destroy, but the impulse to save and to serve and to build. On this first national day of service and remembrance, we can summon once more that ordinary goodness of America to serve our communities, to strengthen our country, and to better our world. Most of all, on a day when others sought to sap our confidence, let us renew our common purpose. Let us remember how we came together as one nation, as one people, as Americans, united not only in our grief, but in our resolve to stand with one another, to stand up for the country we all love. This may be the greatest lesson of this day, the strongest rebuke to those who attacked us, the highest tribute to those taken from us. That such sense of purpose need not be a fleeting moment. It can be a lasting virtue. For through their own lives and through you, the loved ones that they left behind, the men and women who lost their lives 8 years ago today leave a legacy that still shines brightly in the darkness. And it calls on all of us to be strong and firm and united. That is our calling today and in all the Septembers still to come. May God bless you and comfort you. And may God bless the United States of America.
President Barack Obama speaking at the wreath laying at the Pentagon 8 years after the September 11th, 2001 attacks. He's called this a National Day of Service. You're listening to The Takeaway on PRI. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Let's reset the table here while we are waiting for the president to speak at the Pentagon. We briefly spoke with Anthony Fauci, who's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, talking about the very interesting development this morning that the H1N1 flu vaccine, as it's currently being tested, may require only one dose rather than what we originally thought was two doses. Dr. Fauci was just suggesting that this has really two major implications for all of us who are awaiting instructions of what to do as peak flu season approaches here in the Northern Hemisphere. What are the two things that this single dose versus double dose means for all of us, Anthony Fauci?
Well, the implications first, though, with regard to the supply of vaccine, if we had to use up a considerable amount of vaccine, giving people either two or more doses or even a greater amount in each individual dose, namely double the amount that we usually give in seasonal flu, that would have had negative implications with regard to the amount of vaccine we have available for the American public. That is not a problem now because we know we can give it in the same dose a single dose, as we do with the regular seasonal flu each year. The other implication, as we're finding in our studies that were sponsored by the government, is that the immune response that you're looking for appears literally very early. Mm. We found that within 8 to 10 days following a single dose, the level of immunity was that which you would predict would be protective, as opposed to having waiting 2 weeks after the second dose. So the window of protection is pushed much further in favor of the person who's getting vaccinated, as opposed to having to wait a long time before right. you reach your peak immunity.
So faster distribution and a greater availability of supply if we don't have to use double doses. I'm telling you, my wife will kick me. She's pregnant, and all the other pregnant women in the world will kick me if I don't ask you this question. Are there implications for pregnant women who are believed to be first in line as candidates, high-risk candidates in the H1N1 flu?
Yes, as we all know, the pregnant women are at a much higher risk of developing the complications of this pandemic H1N1 flu. And the fact that we can get a robust immune response with a single dose is good news, which means when a pregnant woman gets vaccinated, she will reach her level of immunity much more quickly than we were concerned that she might not when we thought we might have to use a couple of doses and even a higher dose. So this is good news for everyone, particularly people who are at the higher risk of complications, including pregnant women.
And is the single dose and a layer of fears about side effects, that there's less concern about side effects if it's a single dose versus double dose?
Not really. I don't think you could definitively say that. I mean, the safety profile that we've seen thus far is acting just like seasonal flu, which means it really has a very good track record of safety. So everything we're seeing about this vaccine for the pandemic flu is suggestive that it's really comparable to what we're seeing with seasonal flu.
Now, we've been poring over the wire stories and the news stories this morning. Middle of October is the availability that we're seeing. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the way the vaccine is going to be rolling out, we're going to get a big bolus of about 50 million doses ready to distribute in mid-October, and then subsequent to that, about 20 million a week thereafter, till we reach that landmark of getting about 195 million doses for distribution.
All right. Well, you're going to have a busy day today. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, I'll send you off to your news conferences.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. Talking about the single dose as opposed to the double dose expectation that when the flu vaccine is available, you'll just need to be stuck once.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. If you're making weekend plans on this Friday, we've got some suggestions, some new movies, and a film festival up in Canada that you should be watching and paying attention to. That's in just a few minutes. But first, let's check in with today's top news stories. Femi Okeh is here.
And it's almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The president told mourners at the Pentagon's 9/11 memorial to renew their resolve against those behind the attacks on September 11, 2001, and to turn that resolve into a commitment to service. Vaccine makers say that the new H1N1 shot could be stronger than predicted. Clinical trials show that most adults will only need one dose to be protected. That means that millions of Americans who are at high risk from the virus could be vaccinated before peak flu season. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner gave an upbeat economic outlook to the congressional panel that oversee TARP funds yesterday.
I think the U.S. financial system today is in substantially stronger shape than it was 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, and on the eve of this recession.
Secretary Geithner says that we don't need some Wall Street bailout programs anymore. Our partner, The New York Times, has a front-page interview today with the leading Senate Democrat on military issues. Carl Levin says that he's against sending more combat troops to Afghanistan until the U.S. speeds up the training of Afghan forces. Meanwhile, NATO says that two of its troops have been killed in eastern Afghanistan, including a U.S. service member. And staying overseas in Iraq, Iraqi officials say that inmates at Abu Ghraib prison started a fire and attacked guards in a riot last night. Iraqi troops and American helicopters were called in to help security forces regain control. Back in the United States, the president has accepted South Carolina Congressman Joe Wilson's apology for heckling him during his health care speech. But now House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn wants Wilson to tell the House he's sorry or face a resolution of public disapproval. And finally, NASA is hoping to bring the Space Shuttle Discovery home tonight, but the weather in Florida could be worse than the storms that kept the Discovery in orbit yesterday. NASA says that landing in California is still an option. And those are some of the big stories we're watching today.
Thank you, Femi.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
On Friday, we're thinking about movies. You may be thinking about the movies that come out today. We're also thinking about movies that are going to be coming out over the next several months. And we are joined on Friday, as we often are, by Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday here in the studio. Good morning, Rafer.
Morning. How are you?
And Karina Longworth, who's normally here in the studio, editor of Spout Blog, daily film and culture blog, is actually up in Toronto, Canada, the location of the Toronto Film Festival. Good morning, Karina.
Hello.
Having fun up there?
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to talk with you in a minute about things to look for coming out of that festival, because Toronto is a very influential film festival. But Rafer, as far as Friday is concerned, what are you looking forward to this weekend?
I guess I'd be looking forward to The Most Nine, the animated film from Shane Acker, produced by Tim Burton. It's a pretty interesting film. It's visually very thrilling.
Which is a signature of Tim Burton.
A signature of Tim Burton, for sure. Also very dark, another signature of Tim Burton.
Right, exactly.
And you know, my one concern about it is that even though the visuals are terrific and really interesting, it's very, very intense. It takes place in a post-apocalyptic world that's ruled by machines, and the only sort of life left on the planet seems to be these little ragdoll creatures that have some sort of a soul, so to speak.
Is it fair to say this is WALL-E for people prone to suicide?
That'd be fair to say. Sort of a gothic WALL-E.
What's this?
I found him in the emptiness.
What were you doing out there?
I
You lead the beast straight back to us.
But
how many times have I told you?
The beast? That's what took two. If we hurry, we can save him.
If the beast took him, that's the end of it.
But he was still alive.
No, we have rules.
One of the features of Tim Burton films, and that's a clip from Nine, is that he creates these worlds that you immerse yourself in. You can kind of imagine yourself sort of being a fly on the wall. And does it work here?
It does. It works very well. Again, for young children, perhaps too well, you know, the beast they're talking about, which is the machine, is this pretty intimidating monster. You know, it occurred to me that if it were a Disney film, the monster would be a lot of snapping jaws and roaring, but nobody would ever actually get it. And in this film, people definitely get it.
Right, so, which means your kids will be waking up in the night screaming.
Very
about
possibly.
The movie Nine. All right, what else are you looking at this weekend?
You know, I actually I thought Whiteout, the new Kate Beckinsale mm-hmm. thriller, was perfectly okay. I'm a big fan of the B-grade thriller, and that's pretty much what this is. It's a perfectly decent popcorn movie, not a lot of surprises, kind of an old-fashioned detective mystery story. Definitely a little cliched, but, you know, it takes place in Antarctica. She's a U.S. Marshal stationed out there. Bodies begin appearing in the ice. It has not gotten great reviews and probably, you know, won't, but I thought it was a perfectly enjoyable popcorn film.
All right. Hold there, Rafer Guzman. We'll come back to you in a second. Karina Longworth, the Toronto Film Festival, a really important film festival, actually a really important location for producing films also in Toronto. What are you seeing up there at the festival?
One of the things that Toronto is really good at is launching studio films for the fall and films that studios are going to be launching big Oscar campaigns for. So we're seeing a lot of movies with stars like George Clooney, and predictions that these are going to be the things that people are going to be looking at in January, February, March.
Well, what about The Men Who Stare at Goats? Listen to this cast: George Clooney, Ewan McGregor, Jeff Bridges, Kevin Spacey. Let's listen to a clip.
I'd heard that the U.S. government was training psychic soldiers and that Lynn Cassidy was the best of the best.
I've been reactivated. I'm on a mission.
I could come. Lynn's story was unbelievable, crazy, and completely true.
The Men Who Stare at Goats. Now, is this a serious film or a little bit like Inglourious Bastards, kind of half serious?
It's not like Inglourious Basterds. It's definitely a comedy. It's sort of a road trip buddy comedy. A lot of the movie takes place with George Clooney and Ewan McGregor driving from Kuwait to Baghdad together, getting into scrapes. And then there's also flashbacks to Clooney's days as the star hippie of the army. It's I think it wants to be sort of a Dr. Strangelove style satire with this buddy comedy element thrown in. But it's just not really funny enough. And the jokes are kind of too gentle.
And what is often the case is once the festival happens, there may be a recut of the film. And as you've reported in the past, sometimes the recuts actually work where the festival version didn't. Tell us about this movie, An Education, which has got the work of Peter Sarsgaard on display.
Mm-hmm. An Education premiered at the Sundance Film Festival first in January, and it was a huge hit there. It's basically a coming-of-age tale set in the 60s in London about a 16-year-old schoolgirl played by this new actress, Carey Mulligan, who starts dating a worldly 30-something, played by Sarsgaard. And he opens up her world to include art auctions and dog racing and nightclubs, but also kind of gives her a stigma at school. I think the film stumbles a little bit over its commentary on pre-sexual revolution, gender realities and whatnot, but there's no doubt that it's a star-making performance for Carey Mulligan.
You are so good, Karina. You did not even stumble with that sentence. I'm going to replay that when I get home today. Karina Longworth, editor of Spout Blog, Daily Film and Culture Blog, talking about the Toronto Film Festival. Rafer, one more for this weekend.
One more for this weekend. That's a toughie. There's not much more out there. I know that the new Tyler Perry film will probably do pretty well.
I Can Do Bad All by Myself.
That's correct. It's one of his Madea films where he puts on the fat suit and the gray wig and plays the kind of the angry, rageaholic grandma character. Again, I think you have to be a Tyler Perry fan to enjoy these films, but it's almost guaranteed to go to number one.
Will Final Destination be, at the end of the weekend, the biggest box office? That was the surprise last week. It's sustained for the last 2 weeks.
It's got
kids
legs,
and death, just
so
can't,
to speak.
Kids and death. You just
right.
can't.
That's right.
Can't go. Final thoughts, Karina, before we go?
I think that An Education is probably going to be one of the huge standouts of this festival, and I'd be very surprised if Carey Mulligan doesn't get nominated for Best Actress.
Really? And when will that be out?
That comes out in October.
So that's right around the corner. And The Men Who Stare at Goats, when can we expect to see that?
Early November.
Thanks so much. The movies are all going to be on our website, takeaway.org. Karina Longworth is editor of Spout Blog, a film and culture blog. And Rafer Guzman, our film critic and also the film critic for Newsday. I asked him a trivia question off air. Who's the one Oscar-winning director who also has his face on a lunchbox? He paused 2 seconds and said, oh, yeah, that's Ron Howard. Happy Days Lunchbox, I'm telling you. I'm going to get a trivia question for him next week. So as we wrap up this morning, we want to pay our respects to the victims and the families who were affected 8 years ago on this day. Memorials and remembrances taking place all over the United States. We want to hear your stories, how your life changed 8 years ago today. 8778-MY-TAKE.
Hi, my name is Mike from Brooklyn, New York. I remember where I was on September 11th. I was a college senior. I was in one of those three-hour seminar courses. We took our 15-minute break, and the student center was filled with people watching TV. It was a college outside of Boston, but many, many people from New York were crying and running all over the place, and I'll never forget that moment.
This is Joe from Long Island. As I sit in my office and remember this 9/11 anniversary, I'm really feeling that Americans have redefined what it is to be patriotic and that we have to hate other people to prove our patriotism.
You know how to reach us, 8778-MY-TAKE. Have a good weekend. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.